Good afternoon, everyone. Although it has been raining today, this week has been wonderful. I love this weather. Also, now I'll be the third person to mention the fact that Bethany is here today. That's great on two levels. It's one, great for them that they're here, but also it takes pressure off of me, because if this is terrible, all they're going to remember is that Bethany came today. So, which works out well for me. Right before feast, in fact, the Sabbath before we left for feast, Justin gave a message, and in his message he talked about making sure that we spent time at the feast reading and studying God's Word. And he kind of challenged us to make sure that we didn't just read during, you know, services, but that we spent time in study. And I tried to take his advice, and what I'd like to talk about today is one of the things that I was looking at Feast this year. That's over in Psalms 15. If you'd like to open up today, we're going to attempt to at least start going through Psalms 15. A very short chapter in the Bible. There's only five verses, but there's a ton that's packed into these five verses. And as you start getting into it, you can unpack, and it just kind of goes down a bunch of different avenues, and so we're going to chase some of those avenues down today, or at least attempt to. Psalms 15 and verse 1, it says, "Lord, who may abide in your tabernacle, and who may dwell in your holy hill?" On the surface, we read this, and we say, okay, well, the question is asked, who's going to be with God? There's actually more to it than that. What I want to focus on is two words here, abide and dwell. Now the word abide there, and I won't give you the Hebrew, but the word abide there is sojourn. It's a traveler, right? And some of the commentaries mention that it's like someone without original rights. That's the kind of thing that it carries. And I'll talk about Rebecca for a moment. Rebecca, when she was dating Jeremiah and coming down here, she would come down to the U.S. She'd come down here into Pennsylvania. But she was sojourning in America. She had no original rights. It wasn't until she married Jeremiah, became a citizen, that she got original rights. That's the concept. That's the kind of thought process when you read that word sojourner. An example of that, and I won't turn over there, but if you'd like to write down Genesis 12 and verse 10, in Genesis 12 and verse 10, Abraham goes down to dwell in Egypt during a famine. Now, Abraham didn't become an Egyptian. Abraham wasn't there permanently. He was sojourning in Egypt temporarily during that famine. We see that in the context here. In the very beginning of verse 1, it says, "Lord, who may sojourn in your tabernacle, in your tent?" It's temporary. This is not a permanent statement, right? Now, if we look at the other word there, that you may dwell on your holy hill, the word that's used, dwell there, means to settle down or to establish. It carries with it a more permanent tone. Where sojourn is temporary, dwell is more established. I will use an example again in Genesis. And again, if you can write it down, I'll have you turn there. Genesis 3 and verse 24. When God drives Adam and Eve out of the garden, he established the cherub at the garden to guard it. That word that's used in Genesis 3 is the same word used here for dwell. He established the cherub there to make sure that no one would get into the garden. Another example maybe carries a little more weight is Jeremiah 7, verses 1 through 3. Again, just for this purposes, I won't have you turn there, but if you'd like to write it down, Jeremiah 7, verses 1 through 3, God's talking. He says, if they only, referring to Israel, if they only would obey, God would cause them to be established in the land. Not that I'll put them there temporarily, but if they would have followed God, he would have established them in the land. Again, we see this in the context, who may dwell in your holy hill. I'm going to go back to Psalms just a few pages here. Psalms 3 and verse 4. I cried to the Lord with my voice, and he heard me from his holy hill. God dwells in eternity. The concept on the second part of this is permanent. It's permanent. What I want us to notice in the beginning here of Psalms 15 is that it's two very important questions, but they are a little different, that's being asked. Who will walk with God now, and who will dwell with God in eternity? The answer to both is the same. But there's two different questions being asked. And it's important for us to understand that there's two questions being asked here. And we'll get into that. But I want to jump down to the very end for a moment. The very end of Psalms 15, it says, "He who does these things shall never be moved." So, in the very beginning of Psalms, who's going to walk with God? Who's going to dwell with God? And at the end, the conclusion, well, whoever does these things will never be moved. It means that we need to pay attention to what's said in between those two statements. Who's going to live with God? Who's never going to be moved from God? Here's the answer. So that's why it's important that we understand what's being said in between those two things. Before we get into the answer, I want to notice that the question presupposes that we understand the temporariness of this life and that there is a future permanence. Before we get into answering the question, the question itself sets us up. We have to understand that we're temporary. We have to understand that there is a permanence in the future. The question is asked assuming that you already know that. If we turn over to Hebrews 11 and verse 13. If you'd like to make fun of me, I'll tell you that I had to look up the word presupposes to make sure I was using it correctly there. And I was. Hebrews 11 and verse 13. This is talking about the men and women of faith. He says, "These all died in faith, not having received the promise, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth." You know, they understood and knew that they didn't belong here, that they were sojourners, that their life was temporary, that they were looking for something else, that what they did here was not permanent. If we turn over to 1 Peter 1 and verse 17. 1 Peter 1 and verse 17. "And if you call on the Father who without partiality judges according to each one's work, conduct yourself throughout the time of your stay here in fear." Peter talking about the fact that we have this amount of time that we're staying here. It's not work out the time that you're going to be here forever, but there's this amount of time, right? He says, going on, "knowing that you were not redeemed with corruptible things like silver or gold from your aimless conduct received by traditions of your father, but with the precious blood of Christ as of the Lamb without blemish and without spot." We walk through this life, this temporary life, and we understand that it's temporary, and we're confessed that it's temporary, but understand that we are redeemed by Christ's blood that is not temporary. He goes on to say, "He indeed was foreordained before the foundation of the world." I want to stop there for a moment because we know in other places it says he was slain before the foundation of the world. That world there is cosmos. That means everything. It's not the foundation of the United States or the dirt that's pushed together to form Europe, right? It's before everything. What I want us to understand about this and really understand what's being said here, before the physical, any physical existed, the plan to take us from temporary to permanent was established. Christ's sacrifice was established from the beginning, before the physical existed. Peter here is telling us, make sure that you understand that your time here is temporary, that you are redeemed by Christ, by His blood. And that process was established before the earth was ever created, before anything in the cosmos, the universe, everything, before physical existed, before temporary existed. the process to go from temporary to permanent was laid out in Christ. His blood is permanent. There's no temporariness there at all. I'm going to go back over to Hebrews 11 and just finish that thought. Hebrews 11 confessed that they are strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. And if truly they had called to mind that country from which they had come out, they would have opportunity to return. But now they desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. Notice that it says, therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God. If we want God to not be ashamed of us, we need to recognize that we're temporary, that we're desiring a permanent home, a heavenly home. It says that, therefore, he is not ashamed. He's not ashamed because they openly admitted that they were sojourners. And part of this helps us to start asking the question. If we recognize that we are temporary and we recognize that there is a permanent state in the future, it then forces us to ask the question, okay, well then what do we need to do? What is the process? How do we go from temporary to permanent? You can't ask that question unless you understand that you're temporary and that there's something permanent and that there's a process to go from one to the other. So, again, packed in this is a long introduction to this message, by the way, but packed in that very first scripture is understanding that we are temporary, that there is a permanent in the future, and that there is a process. Once we understand that, then we can ask the question. Then we can say, who is it that can walk with God now, and who is it that will dwell with God in the future? So it's a long introduction there, but I think it's important for us to understand that. Go back to Psalms 15. Psalms 15 and verse 2, he says, he who walks uprightly and works righteousness and speaks the truth in his heart. And one of the things I want to point out before we get into each one of these individually, walks, works, speaks. These are actions. Being a Christian means doing something. We don't become converted in Christians and just sit down and say, now I can wait until God returns. You know, Matt Finchel was an instructor that I had when I was in ABC, and I liked him a lot. We got along. And about, I don't know, 10, 12 years ago, he gave a message at the GCE called the Caravan or the Citadel. And the message was essentially saying, as a Christian, as a church, we have two options. We can be a caravan or we can be a citadel. And he goes through the message, and you can look it up if you'd like. I'm not going to rehash that message, but we are a caravan. We're moving. We're a church on the move. We're a people on the move. As Christians, we're constantly moving and growing. There's action involved. We don't put up walls and a roof and say, okay, we're going to park ourselves right here until Christ comes. Because we've got it all figured out and we've done everything we need to do. We're good now. We're just going to sit. You know, we see these three things that's first laid out, walks uprightly, works righteousness, speaks the truth. There's action. There's things that we're doing. So let's look at that walking uprightly. Uprightly means perfectly or blameless. Depending on your translation, it might say perfect or blameless. Barnes notes here, says the word here in Hebrew perfectly means that which is complete in all its parts, where no part is missing or is defective. Not denoting freedom from sin, but as meaning that the character was complete in all its parts. I'm not smart enough to understand what that means, so I had to go to some other commentaries. And essentially, what's being said here is that you do not have hypocrisy. that in your character you're not full of hypocrisy, that you are walking upright or perfectly, meaning not that you are sin-free, because we know that we cannot be 100% sin-free, and not that we never make mistakes, but that we're doing everything we can to walk in the way of God, and that we're not hiding parts of our life, and that we're not hiding things in who we are. Now, I made a note here that says, only you and God can truly know yourself. I want to tell a story for a moment. When I was a kid, growing up in the church, there was a couple, an older couple in the congregation that everyone loved and everyone adored and everyone looked up to. And we would go and have night to be at their house. I remember their house vividly, and I remember them being great people. They were the Gary and Sandy of our congregation. Everyone loved them. You couldn't help but like them, right? Just great people. And I remember my parents, you know, they'd come over all the time. We would go to their house. Amazing people. But as time goes by, you know, I grow up, I move away. I was shocked to find out years later of what happened to those two. It turns out, and this is nothing like Gary and Sandy. I shouldn't have put their name in there. This is not a good story at the end. It turns out that the husband, for years, had been abusing his wife. And finally, he abused her so badly that he put her in the hospital. And he was so ashamed that people were going to find out who he really was that he committed suicide. Because he did not want the people in the congregation knowing what he was capable of or what he was doing. We were shocked, blown away by that. Sad, immensely sad. The reason I tell you this story is that when you walk uprightly and blameless, it's not that you never sin. It's that you have no hypocrisy. It's easy to come into the four walls here and look righteous. It's easy to come in here and act like a good Christian. And it's really not that hard. It's actually not that hard to be at work and put on a show. You can go your whole life and have everyone fooled that you are a good person. God knows, you know, maybe your spouse knows. The concept of walking uprightly is not that you never stumble, not that you never sin. It's that you are pure in what you do. That there's no hypocrisy. That you're not putting on a show. It's easy to put that show on. I'll tell another story, and this one's on myself. And this one's a little funnier. Several years, this 10, 12 years ago, I'm working as a foreman for a construction company. And we had a guy that oversaw all of our foundation and concrete work. And him and I didn't get along at all. So one day, I finished up my project. I had nothing to do, so I go over and I spent the rest of the day helping his crew out. And he shows up at the job site, and he's just giving me a hard time. I mean, what had happened is that he had made a mistake. I didn't cover his mistake, and he was just railing me for not covering his mistake. And finally, after about 20 minutes, I turned around and looked at him in front of everyone and said, "I don't give a blank." And I turned around and I went back to work. About 15 minutes later, one of the guys that I'd worked with for several years, he came over and he put his arm around me and goes, "I knew you were like the rest of us." Patted me and walked away. Now, at the moment, I felt about this tall. Not because I had let my anger out. Not because I had allowed myself to make a mistake. But because I thought I was better than I was. I had put on this air of righteousness, and I had let that slip. For a moment, maybe I gave the church a bad name. Maybe I gave Christianity a bad name. Maybe I gave God a bad name. How aware are we that walking uprightly is more than just being blameless? It's carrying the name of God. If we turn over to Ephesians 4, turn over to Ephesians 4. Verse 1. Ephesians 4 and verse 1, it says, I therefore, prisoner of the Lord, beseech you to walk worthy of the calling in which you are called. Now, if we're not careful, we read this section and say, okay, I need to be worthy of this calling. I need to make sure that I'm so good that God goes, man, I'm really glad I sent my son for that guy. I'm really glad that he died for Matt Earls, because man, is he worthy. That's not what we're reading here. Let's read further. Walk worthy of the calling in which you were called, with all lowliness and gentleness, with long suffering, bearing with one another in love, endeavoring to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. There's one body and one Spirit, just as you were called in one hope of your calling, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is above all, through all, here's the key, and in you all. Walking worthy of your calling is not to show the world that you're worthy of God. Walking worthy of your calling is that you are walking with God in you, that you are carrying God, in that you're carrying like a banner. You're carrying the name of God. You're carrying the name of His baptism. You're carrying the name of that calling. You know, it's not about us. It's not about us. If we turn over to Genesis 17, we'll see this over in Genesis 17. Start in Genesis 17 and verse 1. He says, when Abraham was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, I am Almighty God. Walk before me and be blameless. Same word, upright. Blameless, perfect. And I will make my covenant between me and you and multiply you exceedingly. I want to notice something as we go through here. We'll just scan this for a minute. I am the Almighty God. Walk before me. I will make my covenant between me and you. I will make you a father of nations. I will make you exceedingly fruitful. I will make nations of you. I will establish you. There's a lot of statements in this first section of chapter 17 where God says, I'm going to do these things. You walk blamelessly before me, and I am going to do all of these things. It's God that works those things in Abraham. It's God that does all those things. Abraham simply allowed God to do his work through him, through his life. God did not make a nation out of him because Abraham was perfect. God said, you walk before me, and I will do these things. One of the keys to understanding walking uprightly is yielding our will, yielding and allowing God to freely live within us. You know, Brad's going through Psalm 8, and I appreciate his message. You know, God made us lower than the angels. God gave us dominion over this world. God did all those things. You know, you think of mankind today, we think we have dominion over the world because we're great. We're the best. Mankind doesn't think about the fact that they were given that dominion from God. You know, we're on the top of the food chain, not because we have evolved to that point, because God gave it to us. God set us there. And one of the keys to understanding how to walk uprightly is to understand that we yield ourselves who we are and allow God to do those things in us and through us. And that we try to root out all the hypocrisy that's in us so that we can walk righteously and upright and perfect. I'm hoping by now you guys have realized that we're never going to get through all of Psalms before, you know, 3 o'clock or 3:30, whatever time that is. And that's because for once in my life, I'm going to actually do a two-part message. I tried that once before. It failed miserably. Maybe you guys are waiting for that second part. I don't think it's going to happen. But this time it's going to happen. And that's because I'm filling in and speaking again in 2 weeks. So I figured, you know what? If I stretch this long enough, I can get a two-for-one out of this. So if you don't like what's being said, just don't show up in 2 weeks because you know what I'm going to talk about. Back into Psalms 15. and works righteousness. What does it mean to be righteous? One of the commentaries, and Mark and I were talking about this before services, the concept of working righteousness is not just being righteous, but it's our business. It's what we do. It's who we are. The concept of working righteousness. Yeah, I'm going to use Jerry as an example. I like using people as an example. Jerry, the electrician, that's what he does, right? Are we Jerry, the Christian, who also does some electrical work on the side, right? In the society that we live in, we establish ourselves and our identity by what we do sometimes, right? This is saying that what we do is we work righteous. It's our business. We do this other stuff on the side to pay the bills. But what we do is work righteousness. What is righteousness? Go over to Psalms 119. This is nothing new, nothing exciting here. Psalms 119 and verse 172 says, My tongue shall speak of your word, for all your commandments are righteousness. God's commandments are righteousness. What God tells us to do is righteousness. If we go over to Deuteronomy 6, if I can find it, Deuteronomy 6, we'll pick up the story in verse 25. We're going to come back to Deuteronomy 6, so if you want to put a marker there, you can. Deuteronomy 6 and verse 25, it says, "Then it will be righteousness for us if we are careful to observe these commandments before the Lord your God, which he has commanded us." Now, most people will agree, righteousness is keeping God's commandments. It's keeping the commandments of God. The Greek word for righteousness is dikaios, D-I-K-A-I-O-S. And if you look up in the New Testament Greek lexicon, it defines it as observing divine laws. So this is not an unknown concept that righteousness is tied to keeping God's laws. That's not new. That's not unheard of. Let's turn over to Matthew 5 and verse 17. "Do not think that I have come to destroy the law or the prophets. I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For surely I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, not one jot or one tittle will by no means pass from the law till all is fulfilled. Whoever therefore breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches men to do so will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does them and teaches them shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven." So Christ is establishing the fact that the law is not being done away with, that it's not being pushed aside. But I want to notice something here. He says, "For I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven." Christ ascribes an amount of righteousness to the Pharisees. The Pharisees were the ultimate box checkers. Here's the law. I need to check all the boxes. And if I check all the boxes, I will be righteous. But Christ says, if your righteousness does not exceed that of the Pharisees. You know, sometimes we think of the Pharisees and we think of them as the bad guys. Christ is saying, you're righteous. They have righteousness. He doesn't say, they have no righteousness. You need righteousness. Your righteousness needs to be more than their righteousness. They were the ultimate box checkers. Do we look at the law as just a set of do's and don'ts and the things that we need to check off in life? Went to church, paid my tithe, didn't eat pork this week. Hooray, right? Are we just checking boxes? Because that's what the Pharisees did. They were box checkers. Let's carry on in chapter 22, Matthew 22. Verse 34. "But when the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together, and then one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question, testing him, saying, 'Teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law?' And Jesus said, 'You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. This is the first and great commandment, and the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself, and on these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. The law can be summed up in these two things. Why is that? How do you check a box if you sum the law up into those two things? You can't. You can't. It's no longer a check box situation. Because now the law becomes a way of life. It becomes your character. It becomes who you are. Right? It's no longer something that we're just saying, okay, well, I've done this, I've done this, I've done this. The thing I want to point out here is on these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. You can boil the law and the prophets all down to these two things. Love God with all your heart and your soul, and love your neighbor as yourself. Now, we established a while ago that the neighbor is anyone who you come in contact to in life. Right? How do the prophets hang on these things? What do the prophets tell us? They tell us about Christ. They tell us about His coming. They tell us about the things that's going to happen in the future. They tell us about Christ's second coming. All of those things are talking about God's plan of salvation, what He's doing then, what He did during this time, and what He's doing in the future. And it all comes down to one thing: God's plan of salvation, His love that He has for you and I, His process of going from temporary to permanent. The law no longer becomes a checkbox. It becomes how we live. It becomes what we do, how we treat each other, how we treat God, where we put God in our life, where we put each other in our lives. That's how your righteousness becomes more than the Pharisees, because you're no longer just going, I got to do this, I got to do this, I got to do this. You enter each situation differently. You enter each conversation differently. The people that you look at, are you looking at people through the concept of love? It's hard to check a box that way. It's how we live. The problem that we have is that some people view the law as a vehicle to go from temporary to permanent. They say, oh, we can gain salvation through righteousness. We can gain salvation through keeping the law. The law was never designed to be that vehicle. Remember, from the beginning, from the very foundation of the cosmos, Christ is the vehicle, the only vehicle to go from temporary to permanent. The law doesn't do that, but people look at it that way. People get into this legalistic mindset and say, well, if I just check all of these boxes, God has to give me salvation. Let's go over to Luke 11. Luke 11, verse 42. But woe to you, Pharisees, for you tithe mint and rue and all manner of herbs and pass by justice and the love of God. These you have all to done without leaving the others undone. Everything we do, we shouldn't say, oh, because we have love, because we love each other, because we love God, we don't have to establish the commandments. We don't have to do these things. That's not the point. The point is what is the law about? We don't do one and not do the other. We don't drop one and do the other. Let's keep that in mind. We're going to go back over to Deuteronomy, because there's a point I want to make here, and I may not be making it very well, but if we go over to Deuteronomy 6, in verse 20, and we read verse 25 earlier, Deuteronomy 6 and verse 20, when your sons ask you in time to come, saying, what is the meaning of this testimony, the statutes, the judgments, which the Lord your God has commanded you? Then you shall say to your son, we were slaves of Pharaoh in Egypt, and the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand. And the Lord showed signs and wonders before our eyes, great and severe, against Egypt, Pharaoh, and all his household. Then he brought us out from there that he might bring us in to give us the land which he swore to our fathers. And the Lord commanded us to observe these statutes, to fear the Lord your God for your good always, that we might preserve us alive, that is this day. Then it will be righteousness for us if we are careful to observe these commandments before the Lord your God as he has commanded us. When your sons ask, why are you doing these things? The answer is because what God has done for us. Keeping God's law is reactionary. What I mean by that is that our motivation for keeping God's commandments is because he loved us first. He brought us out of Egypt first. When your son says, well, why are we going to church? Because what God has done for us. See, sometimes we go the other way. We go, well, we're righteous. We're keeping God's commandment. Therefore, God has to do these things for us. It's the other way around. We're doing these things because what has God has done for us first. I won't turn there, but 1 John 4 and verse 19, we love him because he loved us first. Yeah, another one that I won't turn to in Isaiah 64, where it talks about our righteousness being nothing before God. Filthy rags. We're doing these things not because of what it's going to get us, not because of where it will take us, because of what God has done for us. Now let's go back to what we were saying before when we talk about walking uprightly. Walking uprightly is putting ourselves, our self-will aside and allowing God to work in us. Our righteousness is in response for what God has done for us. It's never about us. We're doing these things because of what God has done, not because of what we've done, not because of our own righteousness or building ourselves up. We'll go back to Psalms 15. Speaks the truth. Not only does it say speak the truth, but speaks the truth in our heart. There's a difference between speaking the truth, just saying, hey, this is truth, and speaking the truth in our heart. Matthew 12 and verse 34, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. Right? Before we spend time in truth, I want to make a connection. Let's go over to 1 John 3. 1 John 3 and verse 18. Anyway, we'll start. Yeah, verse 18. My little children, let us not love in word or in tongue, but in deed and in truth. And by this, by loving in deed and truth, we know that we are of the truth and shall assure our hearts before him. Before verse 16, by this we know love, because he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for our brethren. It's easy for us to say, I love you. Peace be with you. Let's do all those things. What John tells us is that we have to love in deed and truth, and that we know that the truth is in us if we do these things. The point I'm trying to make here is I want to tie together love and truth. We can have truth and not make it into the kingdom of God, because they have to tie together. Love and truth have to tie together. I can know everything there is to know and be a terrible person. I can say, you know what, I have all knowledge, all information, I can tell you every bit of truth there is in the scriptures, but if I'm not allowing that to change who I am, if I'm not making that and turning it into action in how I love others, that truth does nothing for me. Nothing. My little children, let us not love in word or in tongue, but in deed and in truth, and by this we will know that we are of the truth. We're willing to lay down our lives for our brothers. That's how we'll know that we're of the truth. Now, think this is a good place for us to stop for two reasons. I'm hungry, and there's always delicious food here. That's a win. No one wants to hear me. Everyone wants to see Bethany. That's number two. And number three, and more importantly, I think, at the moment, is that next time we're going to spend a lot of time in truth. Because one of the things that we do is we mess up and intermingle the difference between truth and tradition. Sometimes we don't realize that truth can be relative. I'll give you an example for that for a moment. For years and years and years, truth was the earth was flat. And all the information that anyone had said that the earth was flat. So during that time, truth, earth is flat. No one would argue with that. It was relative. We know the truth is, that the truth is the world is not flat. I don't think anybody's flat earthers. If you are, talk to Mike. He'll straighten you out. My point is that sometimes we ascribe things as truth that may not be truth. It's something that we have to be aware of. And that's why we need to tie in the fact that truth and love have to go hand in hand. They have to work together. Truth has to spur you to love your brother. Truth has to spur us to do the right thing. Otherwise, maybe it's not truth. We'll talk about that next time. What's important here in Psalms 15 and what will continue in the future, 2 weeks from now, is asking the real question, who will walk with God now and who will dwell with God in the future?